Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome all again to the Audit Committee. I have apologies from Peter De Vink, who's doing his patriotic duty somewhere else. Are there any declarations of... is there any change to the order of business? Any items for urgent consideration at the end? Are there any declarations of interest? We then move on to the minutes from 29th October. Just commenting on this, I know we're all interested in Eskbridge. This work's ongoing, and we will have a report from John Blair, I think, early in the new year on progress on that. Also, further work is ongoing with the contractors. We considered the overcharging of certain contracts at the last meeting. We're also due to have in the spring a report on the transformation programme, which is a subject that's also touched on in the Grant Thornton report, that's item 5. Are there other matters arising from the minutes?
Well, not matters arising, just a very minor amendment on page 4, at the end of item 5, that presumably should say 31st of March 2014 rather than 13.
Are there any other matters arising? I propose we move on to the item 5, Grant Thornton's Scotland's Public Finances follow-up report. We have a contribution to the debate from Councillor De Vink, despite his absence. He says he's extremely agitated at Grant Thornton's report. He feels that continued repayments to the PPP contracts will eventually bankrupt the Council. He wishes the Audit Committee to note his extreme concerns at the perilous position the Council finds itself in. And on that cheery note, could I ask Gary to give the Grant Thornton perspective in the follow-up report?
Scotland's Public Finances National Report. So I've got this. Can everyone hear me?
Yeah.
So a follow-up to Audit Scotland's National Report on Scotland's Public Finances. And we've taken the checklist within that report and we've applied it to Midlothian Council. And this report gives the outcomes from that piece of work. The key messages from the report are outlined on page 3 in the executive summary of our report, and everyone in the public sector recognises that financial austerity is starting to bite across every public body in Scotland, and there's no reason why Midlothian Council would be any different from that. And it's a mix between reducing funding and increasing demand for public services through demographic change, for example. So the key thing that we're testing is how Midlothian Council are responding to that agenda in relation to managing demand and managing expenditure. There are a couple of issues. What we've done is we've gone through, on page 4, we've used our RAG rating system to highlight our findings. So that's red, amber, green. And they pretty much speak for themselves, but there's a definition between broadly meeting standards, which would be green, and broadly where we have some concerns, which we have highlighted as a red risk. Page 5 provides the overview of our findings, and we do highlight one red risk area. And I'll get to the PPP question perhaps as I work through this. So broadly speaking, the Council's facing a £13.5 million gap, and that gap does keep changing. So it has reduced from £16.5 million at one point following the Scottish Government's recent budget announcements. And what we found in relation to that was that the Council didn't have a formalised plan that we could pinpoint that says, here are the work streams that are going to generate £13.5 million worth of savings over the three-year term. This is where these savings are going to come from, and this is how we're going to manage that programme of projects to deliver those savings. Now, it doesn't mean that that doesn't exist, it's just we couldn't see the formal document that captured that. And the feedback back to the senior management team of the council is we think that's an urgent requirement to have that type of plan in place. That's probably a good point for me to kind of stop and reflect on the PPP issue that Councillor De Vinck raises. And members may note the officers did put forward a paper that suggested some savings, so the officer recommendation in relation to that scheme was of a more affordable option. And of course members chose a different path in relation to that. And all that simply does is it increases the scale of the financial challenge facing the council over the medium term. So in effect you have to make savings elsewhere. And the challenge to members is how are they going to do that? And so that's tied up within this recommendation from Grant Thornton that the council needs to have a robust formal plan which clearly shows members and the external auditor and any other stakeholder how the council are going to land in 3 years' time in a position which is going to be financially sustainable. As I say, I think officers have quite good plans in place, it's just how they articulate those. Do you want me to stop at that point and take questions, or do you want me to carry on through the report? So it's not meant to imply that. The authorisation of the budget is a council matter, so full council ought to be approving the budget. The role of the audit committee is to ensure that a proper framework is in place for managing the financial processes and disciplines that enable that budget to be robust and appropriate. So it's around the framework rather than around the detail of the setting of the budget. The detail of the budget, quite rightly, is a responsibility of the council.
Yes, there is no need to change our remit. On the other hand, we will be.
So to be clear, the audit committee's role is around the framework of governance, which includes the financial management framework. It's not for, I wouldn't say, for the audit committee to have a role in determining what should and should not be in the budget. That's a matter for full council. I don't know whether Ken would have, or any of the officers would have their own view on that.
That the budget is a matter for full council is without question. I think in terms of the audit committee remit, I realise that most members won't have that in front of them, items 11 and 12 in that remit, which talk about the Council's financial regulations directives and the Audit Committee reviewing and monitoring the Council's financial policies and compliance, provides enough for the Council then to, for the committee to fulfil its requirements in that regard. That would be my interpretation of it.
So the upshot of that is we are entitled to form a view of the gap that's opening up relative to the budget, and to present our view to the council. I'm well conscious that if we did something formal, like that, that minute would be reviewed by Audit Scotland.
I'm sure other members of the committee will have a view, but for example, if there is a gap in the financial plans of the council, so if there is uncertainty around how the council will deliver the savings required to ensure that it remains financially resilient and financially sustainable for the long term, I think that's quite rightly a challenge that the audit committee could make. How the council responds to that, I think, is a matter for full council. So there is a difference between roles here.
Councillor Baxter.
Thank you, Chair. I would say that our remit, in all respects, not just in respect of the budget, is to examine and scrutinise any risks to this council, full stop. There's not necessarily a risk in a particular budget, but if the council, for example, finds that it's making a deficit year on year, then clearly that budget is unrealistic, unless it's amended structurally. And that is what we would highlight. If we look at a budget and we say that just doesn't look realistic, there are risks to the council, then we have an obligation to question that, but not necessarily to look at the individual items and say, well, we don't like that because for any other reason than risk.
I think the problem is in your expression, look at the budget. We don't actually look at the budget. We look at a number of items that relate to the budget, as if we were driving a car looking at the rearview mirrors. And I think what the pressure from Audit Scotland is for us to be much more forward-looking to determine whether or not in 3 years' time the council will run out of reserves. Because if it does, then the Scottish Government are obliged to take action with us. And right at the moment, this committee does not in any detail review the forward budget. We only look at incidences in the past that relate to it.
What I would say is that as a committee, and this is something that came up very much when we had the training session, as you might recall, you do take the risk register as a starting point for the work you want to do. That's a starting point for the internal audit plan. And it's also an important document for this committee, which comes up on a regular basis. Now, the risk register is being reviewed and will be re-presented in the early part of next year. But it's no coincidence, if you look at the corporate risk register at the current time, the most significant risk facing the council is the financial challenge in future years. And I mean, that will be the case, I imagine, for most councils up and down the land. So given that the risk register is a starting point for the work of this committee, that risk is, you know, flagged there as being the most significant one facing the council, and I'd be very surprised if when the risk register is revisited, if that is not still right at the top or certainly very close to it.
As mentioned at the last meeting, we hope the risk register will then become part of the template for the work of this committee, so we're in a united operation with the rest of the council in identifying the problems. Perhaps we'd best move on to that. Could you speak for a little while, Gary, on the question of where our overspends have occurred? I think Councillor De Vink's point was not so much the question of keeping facilities in Gorebridge and Newton Grange open, which you refer to. It is the fact that when we came to the new battle contract, we were obliged to use Hubco. We had no choice of contractors. We were obliged to use a financial package that included a bond that entitled the holder to, I think, 11% return. This was all set down by the government, and we therefore had a binary decision to take whether or not we had new battle or not, and it had to be on terms that were not attractive considering the financial markets had moved and also the construction markets had moved. It was observed that English PPP or equivalents were being constructed at something like two-thirds of the cost of the contract that was apparent to us. Now, these matters never got anywhere because the Scottish Government weren't prepared to give any flexibility to this council to operate in any other way. And perhaps it is a legitimate complaint of Midlothian Council that we are being forced into these contracts on those terms. And that is one of the reasons why, going forward, that we will struggle to keep within our revenue budget.
I'll go back to what we found and I'll come back to your question then. So there was an overspend in Midlothian Council's budget, but what we're trying to draw out is a bigger picture message, which is I guess, a challenge back to the management team around a greater financial discipline in controlling costs and managing savings programmes to ensure that those are delivered. So that there is, in effect, an early warning system for the council if the financial plans are not going to be met for whatever reason. We do, in the report, document some of the overspends in relation to some of the responses that you get in the adult social care department, where they're responding to unexpected, often unexpected issues of, say, a family presenting and a child in residential care homes that it's very difficult to budget for. Some of those things will happen from time to time. I guess what the external auditor, what we are saying is, I think there is a bigger picture message around overall general financial discipline and financial control, and within that, how you exert control over the efficiency savings programme to ensure that it's delivered on track and on time. So that's my big picture message. Coming back to the specific question that you ask, it's very difficult for someone like me to second guess the financial decisions of bondholders and funders in relation to a project which is unique because it's in Midlothian Council for PPP schemes. So they will react to their perception of risk in relation to that project and set a price accordingly. If we were looking at that, it's wrong to say that Midlothian Council were forced to do anything. In effect, you could have rejected the PPP scheme and not gone ahead with it, and then you wouldn't have had your school.
That was the point. It was entirely binary. We had to take it or leave it, and therefore any attempt to get better value for money was impossible from the point of view of the officers and the members of the council.
I don't really have a comment to make on that. I don't have a view on whether it was value for money or not, because it's very difficult in the circumstances to provide a second-guess judgment. I do know that the council went through their own internal processes and determined, in their view, that it was value for money. Otherwise, they wouldn't have proceeded with it. So, in a sense, they were content with the price.
Perhaps pass on from that and look at other areas. The question for me is Midlothian much worse than other councils? And in your snapshot, we seem to be in a moderately strong financial position now, but the dynamic is that it's going to weaken very radically because of the forecast revenue deficit. And that also plays into the levels of borrowing, which have been quite conservative, but are not going to be in the next 3 years. Perhaps you could comment on that set of causes and effects.
One of the issues that our report draws out is how reserves have been achieved at the levels that they've been achieved by. So you'll see that around £2 million was transferred from capital reserves into revenue reserves through a mechanism in the accounts this year. We don't think that type of approach is sustainable in the longer term. In relation to your overall question, we do think Midlothian Council's financial position at present is reasonably strong. We're not overly worried by that. What we're making a case around is the scale of the cuts that are being required in order to deliver the budget going forward in 3 years' time, and the level of progress so far in delivering efficiency savings, and the efficiency savings plan causes some concern at the present time around whether officers can clearly articulate how they're going to deliver that in 3 years' time. I think there are plans in place. In fact, you know, I'm well aware that there are. I would just like to see those become more robust and more transparent and clear.
Councillor Beattie.
Thank you. If I could just go back to the previous point about the inevitability of the HUBCO position. I think it bears considering the fact that, while taking Gary's point on board and your observations, Chair, there was a situation that while we were faced with a fait accompli of the arrangements put in place by the Scottish Government, within that we really didn't have a choice, because we could have taken a different view and said, no, we don't want to take up that funding proposal from the Scottish Government. But to do that would have left us with a Band D school in terms of fabric of school, which would have left us in a position of either, if we're following the public pound, repairing to a point that was counterproductive and not even properly effective, and simultaneously endangering a serious, proposing a serious risk to one of our absolutely mandatory requirements of providing education for our children, and within that, within an appropriate and safe setting. Those, the two things were not entirely without risk. We had to take a choice about which risk did we face, and clearly one is something that can be ameliorated over a period. Another was not. And if we look at risk in terms of the future well-being of our children, I think we have to set that rather higher than how to manage a financial situation. You can always manage financial situations. You can't manage a child's future when they've not had an appropriate education in the right context. So with that, I would suggest that while I'm not suggesting from it, I'm very comfortable about the whole HUBCO arrangement. I'm really not, particularly given the particular circumstances of that commitment. But within that, I really don't think we had an alternative. But one risk versus another is the point I'm trying to make.
Your points are well understood, and I'm certainly aware of them. Councillor Baxter.
Thank you, Chair. I want to come back to this £2 million transferred effectively into reserves, because I was starting to understand how reserves worked, and I asked a specific question at a meeting once on this when the reference was made to this £2 million coming in from the capital fund, and I was told quite specifically that the only reason they could be transferred was for equal pay claims where the Scottish Government had given authorisation to transfer funds. Now, are we saying here that we're effectively taking out a loan to pay for the housekeeping? Because that's what's happening. If this is correct, then what I was told was wrong at that meeting, and that we're now in a position where we're increasing reserves simply by making transfers from the capital fund, which is very worrying if that's the case. Can I have clarification on the reasons for that?
Well, I was also led to understand it was a simple bookkeeping entry to reclassify our capital reserves as fully utilisable, but I think technically it was all much more complicated. Gary, could you take us through what happened on the matter of, okay, using reserves to fill the revenue gap last year?
So you cannot use capital reserves for a revenue purpose. So that's the starting point within the Local Government Finance Act. What happened here is that general fund reserves were intended to repay principal and loan debt. You can apply the capital fund to repay principal and loan debt. So effectively what happened was that capital reserves were used to repay principal and loan debt, as opposed to the budgeted way of doing that, which is from the general fund. So in effect, what you get is an unfunded general fund. You get an underpayment in the general fund, and you get an overpayment in the capital fund. Your overall reserves, cash-backed reserves, remain unchanged. It's just you effectively, through that mechanism, transfer £2 million into the general fund by de facto. The other side of that is, of course, you have £2 million less in capital fund, and we all know some of the pressures on capital monies within the public sector. So now that, you know, effectively you have £2 million less to spend on capital projects. So in effect, it's like smoke and mirrors, really.
Sorry, no. You know, if you can do this, whatever you want, all councils would probably be doing it and borrowing up to the hilt. But I need clarification on what, you know, you say we're not allowed to do this, and we did it, essentially. Did we get authorisation from the Scottish Government, from Audit Scotland, to be able to do this? Or is that £2 million equivalent to what we paid out in equal pay claims, and we were given authorisation effectively, because that's the only reason I was told you are allowed to transfer from capital to revenue on this basis, is if you have, I think it's equal pay claims, I was told, was the only specific example that would allow it.
I'm not sure it's as narrow.
I'll explain this again. So, Councillor, just to explain this again, this is not really a transfer between one reserve to another. So we asked for an additional representation at the end of our audit in our letter of representation for the Council to confirm to us that the £2 million from the capital reserve had been used to repay loan debt to PWLB, Public Works Loans Board. So what that meant is there was an underspend on general fund, because that money had been budgeted to be funded from the general fund. In effect, it was paid from the capital reserve. So it's not a transfer from one reserve to another reserve. What's happened here is that £2 million budgeted to be spent from general reserves has not been spent. Instead, that funding has been met from the capital reserve. Does that explain? Hopefully that explains.
To a certain extent, what do you mean by the capital reserve? Because my understanding of the capital account is that that is borrowing, and that's borrowing for capital purposes. What is a capital reserve?
Well, so the other side, it's monies that can only be used, that the council hold for a capital purpose, and can only be used for a capital purpose. Within the Act, it defines the repayment of loan debt, because you're either going to draw down loans and borrow, or you're going to repay loans, and it's the same side of the same coin. So what the council chose to do is to repay loan debt. You're allowed to do that from capital funds under the Act, the Local Government Finance Act. That's what happened.
So what is the level of our capital reserve at the moment?
I think it's about 18 to 20 million, something around that.
The consequential question is, the technique we used last year, are we unable to use it this year, or can we use it for many years to come?
So my overall point to you is that money is then no longer available. That's £2 million less available to fund your capital programme going forward. Capital funds are very tight in the public sector just now. My clear message back is that's not a sustainable position for the council to be in over the medium term. So it's a clear message from me as your external auditor that I would frown on that approach. I think it's reactionary. I don't think it's planned. And I would much prefer a planned approach to use reserves for both capital and revenue purposes, which is clearly within a three-year medium-term financial strategy.
But if we were to avoid using the capital reserves, our revenue reserves are liable to run out within 3 years. Is that not the case?
I don't know that it is the case. So what I'm saying is you have a £13.5 million budget gap within 3 years that this council has to meet. I'm saying I can't see a clear, transparent, robust plan at the time of writing this report that will clearly deliver those £13.5 million of savings. Where are they going to come from, is my question back to the council. Now, I know that management do have clear plans. I just could not tie those back into individual projects. I'm tying that message up to a past history of overspend against budgets, certainly in the last year, and to the business transformation programme generally underperforming and delivering of efficiency savings in the past. So this is a challenge really back to the senior management team in the council around how are you going to take that programme forward to provide some greater certainty that you won't run out of reserves and you will deliver your £13.5 million worth of savings.
Okay, we will be looking at the business transformation programme early in the next year. If we are not convinced that we can make these material savings, then what else is the council able to do?
There is no alternative, so management have to deliver that level of savings. The council must balance its books. That's a statutory requirement. What really we're dealing with here is unless you manage these efficiency-saving targets in a planned way, you're then left with having to do things in a very reactionary way. So, for example, you may have to close residential care homes or schools, or you will have to stop doing something. You must balance the books for the council over the short and medium term.
Yeah, that's probably a good time to just update councillors on where we are. I mean, in terms of the budget situation, we have a number of tools at our disposal, of which the transformation programme is one. On a year-to-year basis, and Gary's already mentioned this, the issue of financial discipline. Last year there was an overspend. The report we brought to you in the council in November showed that at that time, halfway through the year, we were on target for £750,000 underspend in the current year. So that's been about the application of greater financial discipline within the organisation and focusing on some particular areas where those overspend in the previous year. In terms of the 13.5 million as we are currently estimating the report coming to councillors next week at full council, which updates you on the projected budget gap. I mean, Gary is right to say that what we need to bring forward formally to the council is how we see the transformation programme bridging that gap. And that is a series of projects which were approved by the council, I think again in November, it might have been October, and it needs to, what it will show is the savings we anticipate from these work streams in the various years of the programme, and therefore whether that bridges the gap in full or whether there is indeed a further residual gap. If there is a residual gap beyond that, and my view is for 16-17 at this stage there will be, then that can be bridged by either additional pieces of transformational work that have to come forward, or other issues such as service reductions, fees and charges, and there's a series of ways in which the council can make proposals for bridging that gap. That is work and train will be coming forward to the council in terms of the strategy leading up to 16-17 early in the new year.
Mr. Ray.
Yeah, I think that's fine and good, but I think we as a committee would probably look at the track record and history of delivery of savings and the business transformation programme was undertaken. I think if we look at page 11, Gary can perhaps tell me if I'm mixing apples and oranges, where we say the council has set aside 2 million of earmarked reserves to meet the costs of delivering the business transformation changes, where the council has over 2.5 million business spent it against delivered savings of 2 million. I think we might look when we see the potential savings, just the credibility of whether these can be delivered, because a sort of professional scepticism might drop in at that time.
I mean, I think professional scepticism is immensely important, and not just for members of the audit committee, I think for chief executives and others as well. I suppose what I would say is that, you know, quite a lot of the work we've invested in terms of business transformation has been enabling work, some of which will produce savings over the longer term, some of which were about transforming the business in a variety of ways which won't necessarily lead to direct financial savings. I suppose the other thing I'd say is that, for example, in 2010 we conducted a management review which took figure I call 3.2 million out of the revenue account with a payback period of 7 months. As members will know, we're at the beginning of another management review process. I mean, the payback period will be different, it'll be longer because we have a no compulsory redundancies policy. But I think it's incumbent on senior management, the management team, myself as chief executive, to be continually looking at such programs, where they're delivering, where they're not delivering, and then taking decisions about either additional pieces of work that have to be brought on stream, pieces of work that perhaps have to be accelerated, or indeed pieces of work that may not be delivering. And as I say, ultimately, I think it's in the interests of the council, and when I say that, it's in the interests of the residents of Midlothian, that we should maximise the efficiencies that come from doing things differently and doing them better and improving or retaining outcomes as we change our approach to the delivery of services. But ultimately, if we need to take decisions about withdrawing from areas of service, then the council will be presented with these options and we'll need to take some difficult decisions. And we've already seen in Scotland this year some decisions about significant closures of libraries, for example, in Murray. And that's just one example. There's other examples relating to adult social care, significant outsourcing of pieces of the council's work, potentially insourcing other pieces of work if that's a more efficient way of doing it. And I think it's about having that combination of the robust plan moving forward, which Gary's identified as an immediate need and one thing that we're working on, but also then having the the flexibility as you go through that to identify the changes that need to be made. And my anticipation is, a lot of people talk about 16-17 has been a particularly difficult year. It will be a particularly difficult year. It will not be the low point. It will not be the low point. The low point will be 2, 3, 5, or even maybe perhaps more years after that. And what that points to, I think local council will have been restructured and reformed within 5 years anyway, but what that points to is significantly different models of service and ways of doing things. And I think that this committee should have an interest in that. It's very important.
Going forward, Gary, what output do you want from this committee? Obviously, we endorse your central idea of having more transparency over the exact manner in which the gap is going to be bridged. We could do things, for example, like have at every meeting a report on the position of the General Reserve looking forward for 3 years and adjusted for any delays or gaps that occur in the transformation programme.
Chair, we have an action plan on page 25 of our report which sets out the expectations from external audit and management have agreed this action plan. You can see the management response to that. I think it is a matter for the committee to really to think through what it feels it would be comfortable with in relation to evidence on this, but I am aware that there is a business transformation group, steering group, that are looking at this, and presumably they will be providing some assurance around the conduct of that programme and whether that's delivering in its aims. But I can't see any reason why this committee could not from time to time look at that. The other thing I would say is, so this report has come out after a period of clearance with the management team, senior management team, and from where I sit, the senior management team have been really engaged in this. So I take a lot of assurance actually from the quality of the response I get from management in relation to the issues that are being raised. I think you've heard from the chief executive who said that management will be bringing forward a clear plan for how they are going to deliver this budget gap. There needs to be monitoring arrangements around delivery of that plan and that, a framework for managing and navigating your way through that. Officers will need that. So I can't see why something like that could not be. How you report that and where you report it, I think, is really a matter for the council, not really for me. The other thing I would say is that we will be coming back in 6 months, 8 months' time, a year's time, and looking at progress and reporting back to this committee.
Okay, so in terms of our position here, I'm very happy to request the committee endorse your report and call for the papers reviewing the transformation programme early in next year so that we start to be more involved in how this gap is going to be solved. I would also, since we keep on identifying this problem, I would also quite like a regular report every meeting on the General Reserve. You've identified that we can be knocked to one side, perhaps by a few families moving in who have deep-seated problems that go to the social work budget. We could be knocked by a very heavy winter. So that General Reserve strikes me as being one of the hot buttons that we need to have our fingers close to at every meeting.
Chair, there's reports on a quarterly basis to the council which set that out, the position with the revenue budget looking forward. And it may be easier simply to refer these on to this committee if this committee would also like to give them more detailed scrutiny.
Yes, I think the stress is on casting it forward 3 years so that we have visibility of where we're heading for and looking at any gap analysis. We had a bad winter, there have been a few changes in social work, whatever, so that we know where the problems are arising and therefore have a better ability to suggest where we might protect that vital reserve. Councillor Bryant.
The snapshot on the Business Transformation Steering Group is 31st of March 2013. I think you'll see savings coming in the end of the next financial year.
Councillor Milliken.
Peter, thank you. It's probably not anything new when you see an audit report coming forward like this to say, well, we want to see how you're going to do things over the next 3 years and we want it now and how we're going to get that. Unfortunately, in politics and in councils, that's unfortunately not how it works. So I'm not really going to get too concerned that we didn't have anything concrete doing in front of us just now. I do, however, think it's with the question Councillor De Vinks raised, I think it's appropriate that the Director maybe answers the question. I think Gary had said there that on the new PPP, we were happy it was base value. I mean, having looked at it in comparison to other PPPs and to the cost of the public pound, I didn't see any great difference in the cost to the public. Where I do seem to think there's a big difference is the cost to the actual council and the way it's been structured. And I think the question there, and I think Lisa raised it quite rightly, is comparison to the repair cost to a Bandy school to the cost of children's education in that school, where does that lie? Because I think the answer I'm looking for here, John, is, you know, are you happy that it was best value, or was it the only game in town is which was used under every other PPP? You might not have thought it was the best way, and you might not have wanted to do it exactly that way, but it's the only way you've got to do it, and that's the area where we found ourselves in under, whether you call it PPP1, PPP2, or whatever you want to call it. You're sort of stuck with that ball game, and you either take it or you don't. So, I mean, in comparison to other PPP contracts, to me it looks like it's at reasonable level. In comparison, that's to the taxpayer, i.e. Scottish-wide, but in comparison to the taxpayer in Midlothian, i.e. the council taxpayer, it looks like it's going to cost them considerably more because the council's having to take up a bigger cut of that slack. And maybe John would like to comment on that.
Thanks. And I'm not going to in here give any guarantees and views one way. In terms of the PPP, what is incumbent on us to do, on me to ensure coming forward, and we've already been asked through various committees, is to come forward with a comparison of the various PPP funding options compared with traditional build, and that work will be delivered in the new year. In terms of the new battle replacement programme, when the report was considered by Council back in June, there was a full assessment of the financial implications both today and going forward, and that was presented in front of Council prior to the summer recess. In terms of Councillor Mulligan's specific point, I will ensure that the detailed comparison of the various schemes does come forward early in the new year, as we've already been asked for by committees of this council.
Yep, I think the issues are well aired, and I look forward to that paper.
I would have thought that was information that the director could have quite easily give us at this moment in time as to where the comparisons meet. Because I have information for his department that quite clearly show that to the cost of the public purse, there's very little difference between the PPPs. It's actually the cost to the council taxpayer, because the biggest burden lands back on the council now. I thought the director could have given that information just now.
Well, isn't the case that the early PFIs had a 80% contribution from Scottish Government, the later ones 66%? My issue is that had there been more competitive pressure, then we would have actually seen a lower cost, because the building costs became highly predictable, the risks were taken out of the contracts, and also interest rates had fallen very considerably in the period. And these didn't seem to me to be reflected in the cost per square metre, especially compared to buildings down south. We'll see some numbers again, perhaps, next year, the February meeting.
I was just going to say, Chairman, it was the Performance Scrutiny Review Committee that Councillor Milligan chaired that specifically asked for, I think, that detailed comparison, and that should come forward to the next meeting. But I do think it's of much, you know, wider interest, and certainly there's no reason why that information shouldn't be in front of this committee as well, if that would be of interest.
I'm sure that we should all consider it, because if we are going to have to make unpleasant cuts, and the electorate say, well, it's because you spent so much money on this new school, we need to be in a position to say, yes, we got as best value as we could have in providing a proper new school for the new battle area.
I think undoubtedly the council will be able to see that, because if it's the only deal you've got, and it's about measuring what Councillor Beattie says against the repairs it's not a list D, it's a section D school, which is in a bad state of repair, and if it's the only way you've got to replace them, it's the only way you've got to replace them. You can either choose not to, and some councils over the years initially started to say, well, we're not taking PPP schools, some of the Ayrshire councils and that, and then quite quickly realised that you either took the deal that was on, irrespective of what government was in charge, and because there were all different ones through the period, you either took the deal that they gave you or you didn't have a deal and you sat there with a crumbling infrastructure of school buildings. And I think irrespective whether it's a good deal financially to the overall public purse, to the council, it will probably be a reasonable deal, because the alternative of repairing and having to fund a capital replacement of schools yourselves, absolutely unaffordable.
Yeah, the decision was skewed because obviously the cost of refurbishing a school entirely falls on the council, not the Scottish Government. So the whole programme, right from the beginning, was kind of binary. You had either had to take what you were given or else you're in a difficult position with your estate. Okay, Gary, have you enough feedback from this committee? Kenneth, are you happy with what's been proposed? Framework. James, I think, is going to talk to this.
Framework I is a workflow case management and finance system, and it's used by various areas across the council, including adult community care, children and families, and criminal justice. Our audit focused on its use in adult community care. The audit reviewed the internal controls relating to the following areas: access and access levels, confidentiality, policies and procedures, data quality, case closure, training, and audit trails. The audit identified a number of effective controls, but also some areas for improvement, including the user access agreements for Framework I not being signed by all users, improvements needed to be made to the procedures for removing access to some users, the need to review the current access rights to make sure these remain appropriate, the number of audits of cases viewed by staff, audit reviews of these, those could be increased. Policy and procedures need to be updated in some places, and improvements can be made to the procedures for data quality and case closure. The audit committee is invited to review the contents of the audit reports and endorse the agreed recommendations.
As I recall, the financial implications here is that due to lax data security, the council was fined, what, 130,000? And also you identified that in one case there was some excess expenditure.
Yes, in one case we reviewed all of the open cases of where an individual was deceased, and in one case there was an overpayment identified. But there's no indication to suggest that it's systemic in any way. It seemed to just be an exception. And that's now been filled by an exception report in the agreed recommendation.
So if we endorse the recommendations, the chances of any further adverse reports should be very low?
Yes, the recommendation should reduce the risk.
Councillor Beattie.
Excuse me. Thank you, Chair. In this audit, was any serious consideration given to generally across the piece staff training and a raising of awareness? Because that seems to me to be a fairly critical link in all of this, is the human error, and where staff, as we know from that incident that happened that caused us to be fined and made a very public example of to many organisations throughout Scotland and beyond, it seems to me that that was very much around the awareness of staff for how sensitive any information handling has to be regarded and how vigilant staff must be. Indeed, that would also apply to councillors, I would think, quite clearly. And with that in mind, was that something that was examined?
There's a piece on the bottom of page 25 on training where it's seen as a low priority, but maybe we should debate that.
There's a recommendation related to training at CHOI on page 5, and something we did find is that there wasn't a robust system of recording the training at the start, and we couldn't get a full record that all staff had been trained at the time. We were assured by management that they had been trained, but it wasn't recorded. But there's a high priority recommendation that they should review this.
Well, so I've been in at your annual appraisal, it would be obligatory to confirm you had gone through training for something as critical as data protection. Is this what happens?
We did do a sort of more general audit back in 2011 on data protection and data protection compliance, and we actually followed that in 2013, and that had some issues around training, because the basic route that's used is a Milo course, and it's compulsory for staff to go through that process. So that was on a sort of more council-wide approach rather than the specific things that James was looking at here.
Councillor Beattie.
If I could come back, I think it's about the huge sensitivity of the data that sits within Framework I rather than that generic process for information generally. That's my concern, because of the immense sensitivity of the information. So it's partly about compliance and partly about proper respect for our customers in general, that we are not just being compliant, but actually addressing the spirit and not just the letter of the law.
Hopefully I can answer that for you, Lisa. All staff within Adults and Community Care have undertaken the basic Milo course, which is on data protection. What I should say about the training that's being recorded here is about how you access Framework I and how that works. And a part of that is about confidentiality. It is about accessing records that's appropriate for you to access and about how you would share information. Now, whilst the detail about the fact that everybody has attended the training isn't as clear as could be, and that has obviously been picked up, you don't actually get a login detail until you have undertaken that training. So there's some issues in the recording of that, but actually you don't get your login data until you have actually signed that off, and that's been signed by your manager. And part of that is about appropriate access to files. So it's not about you've got access to anyone within Midlothian, but it is about being really clear about what you do. And whilst we are increasing the number of audits that are taking place in terms of which files workers have accessed, we do that on a regular basis. So we will check that the files that I have accessed, it's been perfectly appropriate for me to access, that I'm not going out with my remit, that I'm not checking things that I have no right to check in terms of details. And there has been an example recently where actually a member of staff was disciplined over accessing files that they had no right to be accessing. So there are checks and measures that are in place that we can make more robust. But it is very clear in the training, both in the general data protection sense and as part of this, about what is and isn't appropriate and the confidential nature of that information.
Mr. Ray.
Peter, following on from that one, on page 9, recommendation number 11 on access, had a target completion date of 30th November. We're a little bit past that now. Has that been knocked on the head?
It's 30th of November 2014.
Of course it is.
Mosaic is the new, I'm not IT literate enough to possibly explain this, but it's the new framework I is moving on to the next level, so it's the new system that we're introducing, so it's the next version of Framework I is Mosaic, so that will be implemented through the year, so that's why that is a longer date than the rest of them within the report.
Your head, I think you're first in line.
I think one of the problems with introducing a substantial sort of software platform is there's an expectation that it's going to make life so much better and everything's done automatic. And it seems to me, looking at this, while the system promises so much, there's a lot of human interaction and a lot of human activities that have to go on in the background to make sure that it is a robust and safe system to be used. And, you know, when we're talking about, you know, people that should have been taken off the rights and it not being done. You know, the emergency social work team, it says there that there should be an automatic removal if the account hasn't been used after 30 days. It's not actually automatic removal. Somebody's got to do it. And it would appear there's been a whole host of situations where, you know, 63 emergency social worker accounts, only 18 having been logged into Framework I in the past month and 26 in the past 4 months, and they're still on the able to access it, is really quite concerning. And I'd also like to say something that I've raised here before. Lisa spoke about respect, right? With the type of papers that are coming through, these are public papers, and what we talk about the risk is the risk to the council. We talk about access to Framework I is not adequately controlled and therefore Midlothian Council may incur fines or suffer reputational damage. What about the fact that information related to vulnerable people may fall into the wrong hands? That's the real issue here. And it's no helpful for us to put that kind of thing down as the risks when that's the important thing. And I've raised this before because we tend to do that in kind of council speak all the time. And and we miss the whole point of what the security is there to protect. It's not protect the council, it's to protect vulnerable people. And we really should be a bit more sensitive when we're putting that kind of paper together.
Councillor Beattie.
Chair, I think Jim makes the point very well. And Robert's just said something sotto voce to me about culture. And I think it's worth considering that comment again, because the point that Jim's making about this is about a piece of software. What we're actually talking about is there are human beings who operate that hardware and engage with that software. And what I'm seeking as a member of this committee, and it's clear that other members of this committee are seeking the same thing, is some reassurance that there has been a significant shift of culture, that it's not enough to box tick our way through this risk. It's not enough to say we've disciplined someone because something wasn't done properly. It's what are we doing to shift that culture along, that people really start to genuinely get it. The point that Jim's just made, that Robert's talking about, that I'm talking about, and I'm sure others around the table are concerned for, it's a culture shift. It's a sense of grasping that notion that it isn't just about a piece of software will keep us right. It won't. It's what we do with that software and why we think we're engaging with this whole process of care of our activities. What is the fundamental reason for that? And only when that culture change has taken place fundamentally will we be safe.
Councillor Baxter.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I think it's more than just the culture. I think the culture can be helped along the way. I think Jim hit the nail on the head when he said that it's not just the processes, but somebody's got to sit there behind the scenes and do these things. Now, automated processes can be put in place. They don't have to be fully automated. We could have an exception report printed every month of anybody who's not used the system for a certain amount of time, or anybody who shouldn't be using it, or who should be reviewed perhaps after a certain time. So somebody could have at a quite high level have a report on their desk where they've got to check them all, or you know, and make sure that certain action is taken. The thing about within the process which I'd like to query though is why we wait 21 days after the expected leaving date of an agency worker before we remove somebody. Now, in the place I used to work at, okay, it was a bank, it was quite confidential information, but if somebody left that day, they were removed. You don't know the circumstances under which somebody's been removed. It could be a disciplinary offence. They may want to go and take customers away because they're setting up their own company, for instance. You just don't know. And I see no reason why we need a 21-day gap between somebody leaving and removing them from the system.
Really?
I'll try and address the issues from a couple of you. So I may miss something, so come back to me if I have. I am sympathetic of the views within this, and I think with an adult social care, the client does come first, and actually we have a really positive staff group who the positive outcomes for service users is central to everything that they do. Framework I is a recording system, and it helps us in terms of our information management, but actually the central tenant of that is around our skills and training in social work and occupational therapy, and it's about working with individuals. And this is a tool to enable us to do that more readily and more easily, but it isn't the be-all and end-all of everything that we do. There are elements within this that we need to pick up, but actually I think we have very good value base that is very focused on clients, and actually that the things that you've mentioned around the fact that the client needs to be central to everything we're doing, and actually talking about the fact that this is talking about the risks to the to the council rather than the risks to the clients with information getting out. I think all of our staff are really highly aware of those issues and are very conscious of those sorts of points. A couple of very practical bits about the emergency social work service. That's run for us by Edinburgh City Council, and we have been having some issues as they've been making some changes for us around the paperwork and the right access, and it seems to be that they have changed staff regularly enough that's making it quite difficult for us as we're moving forward, and we are reviewing how we provide our emergency social work services as we move forward. Edinburgh still is providing that for us at this point in time, and actually framework is one element of that discussion, but there are some issues for us as we move forward, and we are addressing those. With regard to agency workers leaving, I think there are some disconnect between, I suppose, Trent knowing that someone's leaving, that and the framework I team, and we are needing to be more robust about that. But framework is only accessible from council machines, so they wouldn't have access to the building to be able to have access to this information anymore. It isn't a remotely accessible element. It's not the same as, I know we are turning off the access to email system into January, but actually that isn't something that our staff would have access to out with the building anyway, so they couldn't continue to access that information. So although we are working on tightening that up within the 21 days, it is something that they wouldn't have access to.
Councillor Muirhead.
Can I turn this round a wee bit? Should we know, with something as important as this, move to a situation where there's a positive step to be taken by any individual on a monthly or periodic basis that says they still need access to that, rather than the other way around, where we're struggling to keep up? Should people with access to this know have to fill something in or apply for something on a regular basis that says, I still need that access?
I think that would be I'm just thinking of the volume of staff that we have across all of the areas that have access to that. We can look at that and see whether or how flexible that system is. It may not be monthly, but we can consider that and come back and let you know the outcome of that. I think there might be access issues for that in terms of leave and sickness and how we manage some of that, but we can review that and see whether that would be a practical arrangement.
Okay, I'm pleased that there's a holistic view, because it clearly isn't just a matter of using a system, it's the hearts and minds and the very important human capital that you have to deal with. Thank you for that. We move now to the review of internal audit recommendations, the performance report, item 7 on the agenda, page 27. Graham.
Thank you. This report provides a summary of the number of recommendations that internal audit has raised over the last 3 years, the number that have been reported as closed and the number that are currently still open. The report highlights a significant improvement on the position reported in March. Since reporting, management has indicated that one of the fuel management issues has also now been closed, and that's the one in relation to the signage for fuel. Of the 13 that now remain open, we are of the view that the data protection related issue needs to be addressed as soon as possible, and timeframes have been set for this, but that the remainder do not give rise to any immediate concern. The Audit Committee is invited to note the report to progress and note that we will follow up on a sample of recommendations that have been recorded as complete by management and report this early in the new year. Thank you.
Councillor Bryant.
It's a bit concerning about fuel management, because that came up, I think it was August last year. And of all the things on this paper, that was probably the most important one.
Well, I too have concerns there, because I think we had quite a long debate about it, and Councillor Beattie and others around the table were of the view that we needed to have a position where a given member of staff in a given vehicle on a given day at a given petrol station could be identified as having carried out some act, which might be filling up some green cans but sitting behind the council kit that he was responsible for. And I get the impression there's been some sort of backsliding on this because it's technically difficult or impossible. I wonder if John Blair could speak to this.
Yep. In terms of the fuel management and the monitoring, it says at the bottom of page 28 additional reports have been established. And there's been quite a significant progress from the report that was considered by the committee earlier in the year. But what I think we'll do is in action, I'll take the fuel management one specifically, and I will personally follow all through and come back in the new year just to follow through the gravitas of the points that's been raised by committee, and I will update committee in the new year.
As I recall, the history of it was that only in retrospect, after many months of abuse, were the statistics for consumption so out of kilter that we worked out someone was stealing from the council. And that's why the councillors here, the committee and generally, wanted to have as granular, as particular an identification of utilisation as systems will possibly allow us to have. And if we're not able to do that, I think we need to know the reasons why. On that subject, were there not criminal charges being advanced against the member of staff responsible? Can you tell us what happened there?
I don't recollect the outcome of the criminal charges, but in addition to things in the report, we've taken other steps. For example, we're contemplating putting dye in diesel so it can be traced all the way through. But as I said earlier, I'll take the fuel audit report, I'll go back and I will come back personally with the issues that's been raised by committee.
Yeah, and the issue of the member of staff, because obviously if there's a criminal conviction then the civil processes are rather different, and I'd like to know just where that ended up. Apart from that, I mean, the figure is 96% of investigations have been followed up and satisfactorily implemented.
That's certainly what's been reported to us. As I say, we're going to follow up on some of the closed issues just to make sure that the actions taken by management have been adequate.
Mr. Ray?
When we're looking at the supplier cards, John, am I right in recalling that this was Shell? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we do know that fuel sales and fuel consumption and fuel volumes are falling. Can we not look at some other suppliers for these cars who can actually fall in place and do the programming, because we must be a large purchaser of fuel and have quite a bit of clout with some of these suppliers. You know, there are Allstar, there are other people, other BP, all run these kind of systems. And I'm really sure if we took our business up.
Essentially, there's two types of fuel. There's a fuel that we control within council depots through PIN systems and personal IDs. There's also a smaller use made by garages for largely petrol. The location of the garages, the Shell garages, tend to be in the optimum locations close to our operations. Newton Lawn, Mayfield, and I'm not sure what's at Pennycook, but their predominant uses on the Newton Grain side, so the Shell garages are the most optimum, so we spend more time going elsewhere in downtime. But in saying that, no matter what we do with fuel and any commodity, we've got to have robust controls in place. So I will take your suggestion and look at that as part of the follow-up report I'm going to give in the new year.
Okay, and you cover the 3.71% that are outstanding in the report. Is there anything more to be said on them? You were looking at data protection issues, but there are a few other outliers.
Yes, as I said in the summary, I think the one that was concerning us most was the data protection issue, but there is an action plan to have that in place by the end of March 2014, and that's certainly one we will keep our eyes on
through the information management group, but the others we didn't feel were of material importance, although of course we will do another report in due course.
Thank you for that. I'd like to congratulate you on the level of follow-up and the tenacity with which you addressed many of the issues that the committee has considered in the last year. There being no other business, thank you all very much for coming and look forward to seeing you in the new year.